Incognito, coming from the devil and also supported by our fallen human nature within. And therefore, when Hollywood puts Temptation Street or something like that on its notices, we think immediately of temptation and largely of temptation to sex or sin and that kind of thing. So the whole word has got narrowed down. Actually, the word got narrowed down in the 17th century. Before then, temptation implied every kind of testing from without and within, and not necessarily tempting towards evil. So the word has got narrowed down in the English language since the authorized version was written. Therefore, as we've seen in verse 2, the word means trials, whereas in verse 13, it certainly seems to be referring to those temptations to evil, to sin, which we know so well. The answer is that the word can include both. It's a comprehensive word, a word that implies both outward trials and inward temptations, and the context has got to decide. Now, I want to go on, if I may, on this word remote, just to set the context. If temptation is simply a matter that comes from my fallen human nature and from the devil, if every day of my life I'm going to be troubled by the suggestions from Satan and the suggestions from self, temptation becomes a very depressing business, which is why temptation does depress us, and we say, well, as I'm so greatly tempted, I must be exceedingly weak and an exceedingly poor Christian. And I think that James has helped us already, if you were with us on verse 2, and again today, helps us to get an entirely new dimension of thinking about temptation. It shows us that God is behind it all, that Satan himself is only a servant of God, and that if Satan tempts us, God has allowed him to do so, and that God is behind this whole process for divine purposes. The moment I see that, I begin to realize that this is not quite so depressing after all. It isn't as though Satan has snatched this side of life and says, that's my part of life. God himself has come in and said, well, if you're going to tempt them to disobey me, I'm going to come in on that process and use it to refine them and to make them more perfectly my own. Now, this, I think, is a thrilling thing. It's one of the things you find when you read the Bible. The whole of our thinking today is man-centered. And if you could say one thing about the radical theology today in the Church of England and other churches, it is absolutely man-centered. The moment you read the Bible, you enter a different atmosphere, and at first it's very difficult to realize that you're entering it. And only when you see this do you begin to understand why they're talking as they do. To them, God is always at the center of the picture. And to talk about temptation as there's a battle between me and Satan without God coming in on it at all is impossible for a New Testament writer. Now, I hope that this new dimension of God using Satan and using evil for his own amazing purposes is going to encourage you today. Obviously, one can swing too far the other way, and next week we shall see how the pendulum can swing so far that somebody in verse 13 can say, well, since God is in this temptation, we haven't got to worry if we are tempted. Well, you already know, if you've been a Christian for some time, that every truth is very often put from one end of the pendulum to the other, and that we've got to find the balance between, and that so often heresy and error comes from pressing a truth too far beyond the scriptural boundaries. I told you, I think, last week or the week before, when I was reading the story of Joseph, that wonderful sentence in Genesis 45, verse 5, epitomizes the Bible picture that when the children of Jacob come and they meet Joseph in Egypt, and they're terribly embarrassed, of course, to face Joseph, and they say, we all want to apologize most humbly for having thrown you into that pit and for having sold you, and we realize that we've ruined your life. And you remember that magnificent statement as Joseph simply says to his brethren, you sold me, but God sent me. In other words, don't worry. You couldn't frustrate God's purposes. You tried to, but you couldn't. And that underlying belief that God has his hands on everything is biblical. This whole idea of the God of the gaps is so pathetic, isn't it, thrown to us by so many of our non-Christian thinking friends. Oh, they say your God is the God of the gaps. Has there such a God ever existed to a biblical Christian? God is not the God of gaps. He's the God who is in everything, even in the ability to breathe and speak at this very moment. God is active. Right, then, let's turn to our verse. Now, if I wanted to give a title to this verse, I would give it a word that we've heard already in church this morning, testing, testing. For in putting up this new loudspeaker, you hear these men often doing this. They test it because they cannot hand it over to us until it is working properly. So in verse 12, what we read of is God testing the Christian, testing him through the processes of the battle that we're in as Christians. When he has stood the test, that phrase in the middle of the verse is the key to it. Variously translated, having stood the test, having been proved, or, as one person puts it with slightly ironic words, I think, in terms of today's world when we live with the highway code, having passed the test. Blessed is the man who endures trial, for having passed the test, he will receive the crown of life. Well, it gives the same thought, that before you can be let out onto the road, you must pass the test, and before God can allow you to do work for him, you have to pass tests. And I've often said to young people who consecrated themselves anew to Christ, well now, in the next fortnight or so, God will probably put something across your pathway to test this consecration. So be vigilant, watch for it. Did you mean what you said that Sunday night rally when your emotions were stirred? On Thursday morning, a test will come. It's very interesting that this word that is used here for having been proved is a word in the original docimos, which is used for currency and metal in those days, and comes down into our own use of the language when we say sterling. Sterling worth. That is proved. All the alloys having been removed except for the metal itself. So we may rather ironically call our currency sterling today because we're no longer on the gold standard and we can't even pass the test of many other standards since then. But God wants the Christian to be sterling. Now this idea of testing in the Bible is a wide one and I want very briefly to give this to you if you're taking notes. There are five types of testing in the Bible and they need distinguishing the one from the other. First, man tests things himself, as I've already said, and in the Bible, for example, people test their armor, they test other things to see if they're suitable and worthy. And because they didn't test the steel, which they put at the top of the new Kleinwort building 3 years ago, it bent, you remember, and the processes of the new construction, and the Kleinwort building stood without contractors for 2 years while they were trying to get a steel that would stand the strain. Because the testing had not been sufficient, the contractor or somebody must have lost a fortune. So we test things in order that they may be worthy when we use them. That's a method. That's a type of the use of the word in the Bible. Secondly, man tests himself in the Bible. He's told to try himself. Not every day so as to suffer from a constant self-introspection, but occasionally at the Lord's table, for example, to try himself to see whether his motives are pure. And I take the whole idea of Lenten discipline to be along these lines. It's easy to smile at giving up jam for Lent, but it would do some of us quite a lot of good during the Lent season to try and give up reading the morning paper before lunch, or give up having coffee, or something which has become a sheer habit several times a day. And if you try it, you may smile, but you'll find it extraordinary how one gets under the power of these very ordinary things. You can't do without certain things. And though you smile at the man who smokes 60 cigarettes a day, you find yourself just as much under the tyranny of tiny things which irritate. And I think from time to time we need to test ourselves as Christians that we're not under the power of things. Our friends, you see, are under the power of things. If it rains, they're grumbly. Are we under that kind of tyranny? And so on. If they don't get Saturday entirely to themselves and they have to do something else in the office, then there's trouble. Are we under those petty tyrannies? Are we free? Test ourselves. Thirdly, man tests God, sometimes in the Bible, and this is always regarded with horror. Because, you see, it implies, does God mean what he says? God may very well test us, because we don't mean what we say. But we have no right to test him, because that shows that we don't think he means what he says. So very often in the Old Testament, God is wrathful with the children of Israel because they put him to the test. They say, we don't believe your promises. You produce food for us here in the wilderness and show that you mean what you say. I can't get onto that now, but I warn you against depending upon visible signs of God's presence and testing God in that kind of way. Fourthly, Satan is said to test the Christian. This is more normally what we mean by temptation, what we shall think of next week. Within clear limits laid down by God, Satan is allowed to do this, as is shown in the first chapter of the book of Job. The biblical picture is not of God and Satan having a slogging match over poor little you in the middle. That's not the biblical picture at all. The biblical picture is of Satan under God. Of Satan being a servant of God despite the fact that he has rebelled. Therefore, even though Satan may seek to pull us down, God uses it for our ultimate good. Fifthly, this leads us on to the thought, God tests men. Now, God tests us for several reasons. I mention a few very quickly. To humble us. If God did not test us, we should soon become incorrigibly proud. When success meets the Christian, week after week he finds he is able to witness to his friends a success, everything goes well, we soon become prayerless and proud. If you haven't discovered that, you haven't discovered very much as a Christian yet. And I have found that God knocks me down to the temptation, not that I may fall on my face, but that I may fall on my knees. If I didn't find temptation too strong for me, I wouldn't get up to pray. Secondly, God tests men to reveal themselves to themselves. Self-knowledge is one of the most precious things you get in middle age. Some of you have not yet quite reached as far as that, but there are others who, like me, have advanced into middle age. And you will know that one of the more precious things that you possess as you grow older is a wider knowledge of yourself, what you can do, what you can't. And a very valuable piece of knowledge it is, too. And God reveals ourselves to ourselves so that we become aware of our weaknesses through temptation. And it is sad, isn't it, when you meet people in life, especially mature people, who are quite unaware of their weaknesses. Some weeks ago I was out to dinner with a party of people, and there was a man there who simply collared the conversation, wouldn't stop talking. And I'd noticed it, I must say, but I wouldn't have said anything had not somebody said to me, walking to the tube after the dinner party, "Did you know how Mr. Sensei never listened?" Well, now I had noticed just that. And it's a painful thing, isn't it, if by middle age we've got to the stage where we've never listened to anything that anybody says, but we jump into the argument to give up what we think before we've ever heard what people say. A very tiny point, that. And I think that God sometimes tests us and puts us into difficult situations to reveal these things to us, which we're so blind to iron them out. And God tests us also to reveal ourselves to other people. In other words, God puts some Christians in the hot seat, so that other people who are not Christians, seeing them under trial, may be struck with the reality of their Christian life. How often you hear it said by unbelievers, "When I saw what happened to Mr. Sensei, Mrs. Sensei, and I saw their reaction as a Christian, I began to think there was something in it." Now, there is a key distinction between the testing of Satan and the testing of God, and it's an important one. Satan tests us and tempts us that we may fall and fail. God comes into that same situation to test us, but always in order that we may succeed. In Making Gold or Sterling Silver, the silversmith throws the metal into the crucible to get rid of the base metals. But he does it with the hope, indeed with the certainty, that from his experiment, from his action, will come forth pure metal. He has that hope and assurance that it will be so. He doesn't expect the crucible to reveal that it is all base metal, or he would never have started the occupation. And if God puts man sometimes in the crucible, it is always with the certainty that from it will come forth sterling metal, sterling gold, sterling silver. Now, should God do this? This is the question. You say, this is rather a tough picture of the Christian life. Should God do it? If you'd lend me your Bible, just remember, as I've left my testament foolishly. I'm going to turn you, if I may, to a most marvelous passage in Genesis, which I've been reading, the story of Joseph. Genesis 44, to show you an answer to this question, should God do it? You know, very often when Jesus was criticized for what he did in the Gospels, one of the most remarkable ways in which he used to answer was to start his answer with, "What man of you having or doing?" And he would say, "If you do this, why shouldn't I?" You remember he was criticized for going out for the tax gatherers and sinners. And he said, "Well, what man of you having lost a sheep doesn't go and search for him? So why shouldn't I go and search for those who are lost?" And it's one of the most powerful ways he used to argue. So if you say to me, why should God test us and make the Christian life sometimes so difficult? I would answer, well, we do this ourselves. We find that in life we do have to test people if we're going to put them into positions of responsibility and if we're going to restore them to privilege. Look at Genesis 44. This is the marvelous story, if you glance at the beginning of it, where Joseph is commanding his steward to fill his brother's sacks with food to take back to their father. And he says, put the silver cup in the youngest man's sack, verse 2. So the steward did it. And at morning light, verse 3, the brothers went back to Jacob with the good news that there was corn in Egypt. When they'd gone out of the city, Joseph says to his steward, up, follow after the men, and say, wherefore have you rewarded evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh? Whereby indeed he divineth, ye have done evil in so doing. Now, it does seem, doesn't it, at first sight, as though Joseph is really being rather childish. He plays a kind of game. He puts the cup in Benjamin's sack, sends them off. No sooner have they gone, and Joseph's had a meal, and they've settled down, and Joseph says, now gone, off you go. And the steward goes galloping after them, stops them, and says, why have you done this to my master? And they look all dumbfounded. And he opens the sack, and of course there is the silver cup in Benjamin's sack. And you say to yourself, well, really, we've been told all through the story that Joseph was so magnanimous and how he forgave his brothers, but here he seems to be playing with them like a cat with a mouse. And I thought that, I confess, until I read the story again this last week. And I came to see that Joseph was doing something very simple but very remarkable. He was testing whether this repentance they had expressed by lip was real. Now, you remember what their fault was? Their fault was that when Joseph was the youngest son, they had dumped him because it suited them to do so. They were callous and cruel. Only the fact that the Midianites happened to be going through on a caravan train enabled them to sell him. Otherwise, they'd have given him to the wild beasts. When it suited them, those other 11 brothers had dumped Joseph when he was a lad. And the question in Joseph's mind was this. Would they do it again? Would they do it again? And so he tested them exactly on this. The youngest now is Benjamin, his actual younger brother, because he shared the same mother with Benjamin, of course. And so he puts the cup in Benjamin's sack. Now, they're in a very, very hot spot, aren't they? Because, after all, Eastern rulers, Middle East rulers in those days, cut your head off rather than ask for your reasons. And they knew very well that Joseph had all power. And the steward comes out and he finds it is absolutely irrefutable. There is the cup in Benjamin's sack. And as far as they can see, Benjamin has been the most appalling fool. Here were they just about to rescue their whole family, and Benjamin has wrecked it. Now, are they going to dump Benjamin? That's the question, isn't it? That's the whole point of the story. How easy to do. How easy to say, well, this young fellow has been a fool. You take him back then to Joseph. And let Joseph do with him what he will. And to go back to their father Jacob and say, well, we've lost Benjamin, but it was his own fault. Now, you would expect them to have done that. Indeed, some years before that, they would have done that. He would have been tempted to do that. But what happens, verse 13? Then they rent their clothes and laded every man his ass and returned to the city. They went back to judgment. They went back to what? Certainly, as far as they could see, would mean punishment and loss of freedom and the end of everything. It's a very, very telling verse, isn't it? That every man went back. They need not have gone back. They could easily have escaped and left Benjamin. Verse 14, now Joseph is not prepared yet to see this as wholly satisfactory. So when they get there, Joseph says, what deed is this you've done? Verse 15. And Judah, who is the spokesman, what shall we say unto my lord? Verse 16, what shall we speak? How shall we clear ourselves? God hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. You see, they identify themselves completely with Benjamin. They stand with him. They don't let him stand alone. And so Joseph naturally answers, verse 17, God forbid that I should do so. God forbid that I should punish all of you. I have no quarrel with any of you. But the man in whose hand the cup is found, he shall be my servant. And as for you, get you up in peace and go to your father. So I have nothing against you. I have any against this young man. He shall be my servant and slave. So the test, you see, was a very real one. Scot-free, you can go. Off you go. And then you get this marvelous speech, which we haven't time to read, Judah, coming and saying that he'll be a substitute for Benjamin. And my lord, let thy servant, I pray thee, speak a word in my lord's ears, and so on. As Derek Kidner says in his latest commentary on Genesis, you see that the men stand absolutely revealed, don't they, by verse 13 and verse 17. In other words, there has been a complete change of heart. The test that Joseph has given them was a very searching one, and they have come through the test. And Joseph is able to forgive them, knowing that they are not the people they were when they dumped him all those years before. Now that is why God tests us. Are we the same men as repented a year ago when we had that illness, perhaps, and we repented and we told God we would do certain things, we would put certain things right? A year has gone by, have we? God wants to know the answer, so he puts us into a situation where he'll find out. Now, there is only one objection to this that I can think of, and that is the objection that is as follows. But surely, says somebody, God knows our hearts. He knows very well what's there. Joseph didn't. Why, then, does God have to test us to bring out something he already knows about? The answer to that question is simply to say that it's an impossible question. It's an inadmissible question. The Bible knows nothing of a good heart without good deeds. The Bible knows nothing of this easy way we have of talking, he is good at heart. To the Bible writers, the heart and the actions are absolutely the same. Now, when I discovered this in studying, especially the Old Testament, the Hebrews thought like this, I find it very challenging, and I believe it needs to challenge us. We've got so used to saying, I did this, but it wasn't me. I really don't want it. I'm a different person at heart. And I think when we come up against the rather severe teaching of the Bible on judgment, we find that God will not allow this. So in the New Testament, all they were saved by faith were judged by works. Because our works alone show what the heart is. And God is not prepared to be put off by the statement, well, I didn't mean it, that isn't really me. What I do reveals what I am. So that God tests not by saying what is the state of his heart, but God tests by saying what did he actually do. Once you've got that clear, you find the Bible ethic a very much more challenging thing than you ever thought it was before. And if I may put this conversely, you know, and I think this is a help to many young Christians. Young Christians get very worked up because they don't feel loving, perhaps, to the person in charge of them in the office who's a fearful pain in the neck and always finding fault, whatever it may be. Now, God doesn't ask us to feel victorious, to feel loving. He asks us to act in a right and loving way. And we take far too much concern about what we feel. We say, where are my motives right today? You know, in some ways, don't worry about your motives. Look after your actions, let your motives look after themselves. That's more the Hebrew way of looking at it. I know it's converse to what we're told. All our education is look after your motives and your actions look after themselves. The Bible often says the opposite. Today you know what you ought to do, do it. And if you do that persistently day after day, you will find that your actions and motives follow. For example, I'm getting very, very tired at the moment. Through one or two cases that I've had, I've been asked to give advice of people who tell me that they've fallen in love with the wrong person. The Bible knows nothing of this. There's nothing of a possibility of falling in love with somebody apart from one's own partner. Because this is to live in the realm of feelings. If I have a partner in life, I'm commanded by the Lord to love, and that means not feeling that I love my wife every morning, but acting as though I do. Terribly important distinction. Do you see where the ethic of the modern world is that if you fall in love, well, it's just too bad. Feelings must rule things, and therefore family must be split up, or whatever it is. That's just unknown to the biblical writers, that kind of way of thinking. To them, if you act in a loving way, you will come to love. So it's your duty to act as you think God would have you act, whatever you feel. Don't worry about the feelings, they'll follow on afterwards. I know that could be caricatured and misunderstood, but I think you see what I'm getting at. Now you ask the question, is it worth it? Is it worth standing the test as God puts me in the test I spent, however, a long time on that phrase when you stood the test, but I wanted to show you that God has good reason for putting us in the test. And he longs that we shall stand the test, because we shall become such valuable servants of his if we do by his grace. You say, is it worth it? Well, whenever God puts something before us here which is rather hard, perhaps, he always reminds us of where it leads. When he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him. And this only other time when the crown of life is mentioned in the New Testament is Revelation chapter 2, verse 10, where in a very similar situation, Jesus says, do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested. For 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful to death, and I will give you the crown of life. Crown is associated in the Bible with royalty, gaiety, and victory. The life that I shall enjoy with God in heaven is a royal life, a life full of gaiety, a life of victory. I've spoken often of biblical rewards before, just a few words about them, which I don't think I've said so much before. First, the biblical rewards are justified because they are the proper fulfillment of our activity now. The Bible does not say, in the language of today, collect 30 packet tops and you'll get a holiday in Capri. But that reward has absolutely no relation to collecting your packet tops of your morning breakfast cereal. What God is saying here is allow God to prove you, and you will then be able to experience what only a proved Christian can experience. And nobody but a proved Christian would want to experience. For this is indeed a privilege a Christian alone desires, life, the crown of life. Furthermore, the Bible speaks much of rewards. It is criticized by some people for doing so, because, of course, the Bible is a book with a heavenly perspective. The Bible is very well aware of the fact that rewards and punishments are not given by God entirely fairly in this world. And if there were no heavenly rewards and punishments, we should be hard put to ask why God orders the world in which he does down here on earth. And because the Bible is very concerned to justify God's ways and to show that he is a just God, it tells us that there are rewards and punishments in the life of the world to come. You know, the unbeliever, as always, likes to eat his cake and have it. One day he comes to you and he says, you know, your God allows the innocent to suffer. He got that off his chest one day. The next day he comes to you and he comes to you and he says, of course, I don't believe in all this business of pie in the sky when you die and rewards and punishments after life. You see, he's trying always to criticize both sides. But the truth of the matter is that if the innocent suffer in this world, and we have to admit it, we should necessarily expect God to have another world in which these things are going to be set right. And the Bible picture of heavenly rewards is not simply that the Bible is otherworldly in an impractical sense, but that God is a just God and he's going to put things right. So inevitably the Bible talks about rewards in the next life in order to assure us that any unfairness in this life will be put right. And then finally, of course, this book is a book about God. It's about a book of what God is going to do, and God has made promises to those who love him, and God is going to keep them, and the Bible is interested in what God says, not what we like. If God has made promises, he has got liberty to make what promises he likes. The Bible is simply informing us what promises he's made. And I think, you know, we've got to sometimes learn when we read the Bible that it's not asking our advice as to whether God should offer rewards. He's been pleased to do so. If you are pleased to do something for your children, it's entirely up to you. No one is at liberty to criticize you, especially if you have all wisdom and all power. And God has said that he's going to reward those who love him, and the Bible is concerned to tell us exactly what God has purposed to do. Now, finally, the first phrase, if I may, I've had to be very quick on this, I'm afraid rather inadequate in the last 5 minutes because time doesn't allow me to go into it in depth. But that first phrase I must just look at, blessed is the man who endures trial. That's a very Jewish way of writing, and James's letter is Jewish in some ways. He shows his Jewish origin. It comes only once again in the New Testament, in Romans chapter 4, verse 8. And as we finish today, just look at this comparison, because it's rather lovely. Romans 4, verse 8. Blessed is the man who, against whom, the Lord will not reckon his sin. Verse 8 of Romans 4 says, blessed is the man who's forgiven. And verse 12 says of James 1, blessed is the man who stands the test, for he'll receive the crown of life. Very striking, isn't it, that the way the Bible, as I like to put it, votes man in. You know, one of the things that men lack so desperately today is security, isn't it? I mean spiritual, mental security. We've got all the material security we could possibly want, the bomb excluded, with many of you men working night and day to give us insurance for absolutely everything, and so on. But in a world which has got all the monetary things so worked out that we can have security for almost everything, it's a very ironic thing, isn't it, that mentally and spiritually today young people are entirely without security. So mental illness is alarmingly on the increase. People just don't feel that they can cope, do they? Again and again you hear it. And it's so wonderful to see how God bolts the Christian down into life so that he's free to cope. The past, blessed is the man against whom the Lord imputes no sin. In other words, God says as regards the past, forgiven. The future, blessed is the man who has the crown of life ahead of him. The past assured, the future assured. You see, the Christian is set free from worrying about his past and worrying about his future. Set free to give his attention to today, that he may be free to cope. But like some magnificent piece of machinery, it cannot work if it isn't bolted down. Otherwise it will shake itself loose. And this is our friends today, isn't it? And we ourselves, as we drift from Christ. If we're not bolted down into the realities of Christ, we soon find ourselves unable to cope with the pressures of daily life. Just pray. Sorry, I've been a moment overdue. Blessed is the man who endures trial, for when he is tested, stood the test, is proved, he shall receive the crown of life which God hath promised to those who love him. Thank thee for these tremendous realities. We thank thee that even in temptation and trial thou art sovereign. We thank thee that nothing in our lives is outside thy knowledge. We thank thee that the past is in thy hands and the future. We thank thee that in thy hands we can be set free from this insecurity to stand today as Christians and to cope with life. We thank thee that day by day thou dost prove us, not that we might fall, but that the sterling metal should remain. We thank thee, Heavenly Father, for the sterling Christians we've met, those we know, and we ask that we may be willing to pay the price that made them what they are, that we might be such followers of thine today, those on whom others can lean. We ask it for your name's sake.